Welcome to the Haman Lee Mysteries Resolved podcast, episode 3, in which we are going to pursue the story of what I believe really happened with the murder of 18-year-old Haman Lee on January 13, 1999, and the subsequent hiding of her body and construction of an alibi for Don Kleindienst. Last time, I said that the stage was set for her body to be placed in Leakin Park, which is, of course, where it's going to be found in 28 days on February 9th by a man I believe was intimately and directly involved in placing her body there in the first place, Alonzo Sellers. Now, I'm going to back up a little bit from where I left off last week because I have continued to think and rethink my theories about this case. And I had certainly thought about them quite a bit before I wrote my book. So this has been an ongoing process. So last week, I had postulated that Hayes' body may have been stashed for that critical 8 to 10 hours for the liver mortis to form on the front side of her body, that she was laid flat somewhere for that amount of time for the blood to become fixed in that place. And I was saying, well, maybe she was put face down in the bed of a pickup truck. Either Alonzo Sellers' pickup truck, we know he had one, or, as I had discovered when bopping around on the internet, in the bed of Catherine Michelle's pickup, because I found a picture that showed that she owned such a vehicle with a camper cover, at least in 2022, and that either one of those trucks could have had a heavy-duty, thick rubber liner that would have provided that smooth surface for Hayes' body to be laid down on. But I kept trying to imagine how that would have actually happened in real time. One of the things I am trying to do in this podcast is never to throw out a theory without actually following through on what it would have looked like, how it would actually have happened on a minute-by-minute basis. And I just could not make this theory work. One of the big obstacles for thinking that Hayes' body had been put in the truck bed is simply that it would have had to take place in the driveway of the Michelle Baird residence, which, as I've said before, was at 708 East McPhail Road. It's a single-family dwelling, and it does have a garage. The problem with that garage is that it is a single garage. So if it were a double garage, then you could imagine a situation where Don drives Hayes' car back from the mall, as I postulated last week, with her body in the front passenger seat. He gets the car into the garage and he closes the door. But now what? They decide they need to get that body out, but if it's only a single garage, they can't pull Catherine Michelle's pickup or Alonzo Sellers' pickup, if that's what they used, into the garage beside that car. They would have to be doing this body transfer outside, and that cannot happen. And you cannot say, oh, well, maybe they waited until it was dark. Because remember, Hayes' body must be in the position that the liver mortis shows it was in within, I'm going to say, an hour and a half of death. 2 hours is kind of pushing it. The latest this could possibly happen if Hay was killed around 3 would be 5 o'clock. And sunset would have taken place a little bit before that in January in Baltimore, but it would not have been completely dark. Besides, that's very dicey to be moving a body from one vehicle to another out in your driveway? I don't think so. So I kept trying to imagine this, and I was also trying to imagine, why would you bother stretching the body out flat like that if you're just putting her in the bed of a pickup? And that pickup, we are postulating because of Catherine Michelle's later vehicle, it has a cover on it. So it's not really going to matter how bunched up she is. Why bother stretching her out like that? So here's what I've come up with that I think makes a little better sense. Now remember, these are scenarios that I am putting together to fit the evidence that we have. I am not just fantasizing. I'm tying this story to the little tiny bits that we have of what we know, which is basically the forensic evidence. So let's go back to what I think the role is that Alonzo Sellers played in this tragedy. So my theory that I presented last week was that Sellers had a side business doing concrete work, residential concrete work, perhaps very small jobs of re-cementing things, using the amount of cement that you could mix by hand in one of those little manual mixers, and smoothing down roughened or cracked concrete in order to be able to put a fresh coat on, whatever you could do as an individual with equipment that you might own or rent personally. So that's my theory. That's how he gets pulled into this. And of course, my evidence for this is twofold. Number one, the marks on Hay's shoulders that are most likely caused by her shoulders resting on these little, I call them widgets, little tools, little attachments called a concrete shoe that fit onto the bottom of a concrete grinder that's used to smooth down a concrete floor or a driveway or a sidewalk. So that's evidence number one. That does not directly tie Alonzo Sellers to this. There are certainly other people in the Baltimore area who might have used such equipment. That goes without saying. But then, of course, we have the second fact that does tie Alonzo Sellers directly to this whole affair. And that is the fact that he is the one who discovered this body. And as we go into that whole scene, which will be in a later episode, it will just become more and more clear that there is no way that Sellers found that body by accident. He knew where it was ahead of time. Well, what's the easiest way to explain that knowledge, that he had helped put her there in the first place? So let's back up. Let's say that Sellers had started doing a job at the Baird Michelle household on Tuesday, January 12th. He has a job at Coppin State College, now Coppin State University, a good hour away from this house. How did Baird and Michelle end up hiring him? Who knows? This is kind of before anybody has a website. Certainly Alonzo Sellers does not have a website. I'm imagining the old-timey methods that people used to have of advertising their services as a handyman or an odd jobs man or whatever. There were a number of ways you could do this. Even today, you'll see signs stapled to telephone poles once in a while. Handyman works for reasonable hourly wages, something like that. I don't know if anybody ever hires those people. There used to also be bulletin boards, say in grocery stores or drug stores, where local people were allowed to put up ads for various services, alterations, cleaning, snow shoveling, or in this case, concrete work, small concrete jobs. So for instance, you could put up a sheet, an advertisement on a bulletin board at a grocery store or a hardware store. I've seen those many times back in the day, again, before we had websites, before we had Google, that kind of thing. They were flyers with little tabs along the bottom that you could tear off with your phone number. But I wonder if the most likely scenario, since Sellers probably wasn't driving all the way out to Bel Air to put flyers on a bulletin board out there, was that he took out an ad in one of those weekly little newspapers, advertisement papers. We used to get one called the Thrifty Nickel, and for a very reasonable price, you could put a help wanted ad. Actually, as I think about it, this is very much a paper form of what has now become Craigslist. But of course, Craigslist did not exist back then. So that's probably where they found this. I don't think there's any attempt at vetting anybody who takes out an ad in those little papers, but they wanted their garage floor redone, we'll say. And lo and behold, here's an ad. And the guy says he charges $20 an hour plus equipment rental, something like that. All right, so he's been hired. He probably would rent his equipment, as I say. I had postulated in the previous episode that this was equipment he owned. But the more I thought about that, the more I thought that's not very likely, because at this time, as far as we know, and this is from Bob Ruff, Alonzo Sellers is living on Gist Avenue, which is up north of Leakin Park. And these are low-income row house rental units, and there are no garages. There's no way he had a big, heavy concrete grinder sitting out in the bed of his truck in all hours. So, on Tuesday, we will say, Sellers had brought his equipment over. He had walked through the job with Baird and or Michelle, given them an estimate, and gotten his equipment out of his truck. Anybody who would rent equipment like this would be sure to be able to return it in good order. So now we're back to my idea of his truck bed having a heavy-duty rubber liner. And I'm going to say that he pulled that equipment out of the truck. So it would be this big, heavy concrete grinder. Again, as I mentioned last time, akin to what would be a floor sander if you were doing resanding of wood floors. It's a very, very heavy piece of equipment. So he pulls that down off, and then he's going to leave that equipment in the garage. And so then the next day, the idea is he can come back and get started on the job. So he would have pulled that liner out also. That may have been a liner that he owned and he used all the time, or it may have been something that the rental place required that be rented along with the equipment. I don't know. But it's something smooth and very flat with a little bit of give to it. He puts that on the side wall, against the side wall of the garage. He puts his grinder on top of it to stay off the floor. And then he has some spare concrete shoes that are kind of next to the machine, we'll say. They would wear down as you did your grinding, so you'd have to swap them out. Again, not to belabor the point too much, but this would be like replacing the sanding discs on your floor sander. Okay, he says, I will be back tomorrow. I don't get off work until 4, so I won't be here until 5. But I should be able to get in some pretty good hours of work before I have to go home. We'll see if I can get it done. And they say, okay, and by the way, we may or may not be here. We've gone over things and we've come to an agreement about the price. Maybe they gave him half up front. And they say, we're going to give you the garage door code, or we'll give you a garage door opener. We have an extra one. Now, they don't know this guy from Adam. They don't know all about his weird exhibitionism streaking history. But they've cleared out the garage in preparation for this job. And of course, they're going to lock the door leading to the actual house from the garage. So they feel pretty safe. That's the plan. And sellers may even have said, it would probably be a good idea if I got it done tomorrow night. I just don't really have time tonight now that we've gotten everything all squared away. Tomorrow I'll try to get here and put in the hours I need to finish the job because they say that there is a big storm coming in Thursday. So it would be good if I could get it done before then. He leaves. Everybody goes to bed. And the next day, Don meets Hay at the Owings Mills Mall and kills her. Totally unpremeditatedly in a fit of rage, as I went over in the last episode. So he drives home, that is home to his mother's house, and he pulls into the garage and parks the car and closes the door. Now what? Well, I think his mother must have been home. We know Catherine Michelle is not home because she's going to call from Owings Mills at 7, as we talked about last time. She doesn't know anything about what has happened. Don tells his mother what he's done. She comes out and she says, "We have to get this body out of the car. We'll have to figure out what to do with it separately from the car. That's the reasoning." As I said last time, it would have been infinitely easier to just drive the car with the body somewhere and dump it, put it in some out-of-the-way place. But I don't pretend to know the thought processes here. But they had to have taken that body out of the car. Now, what are they going to do with it? Because by now, it's starting to get dark. Remember, Owings Mills is a full hour away from this house. It's starting to get dark. Plus, as I discussed last time, Don has to get his own car out of that parking lot because there's no overnight parking allowed. So what do we do with the body in the meantime? We don't have time to take it anywhere tonight. We've got to do other things. And besides, it's getting dark. Well, here's this floor mat with this equipment sitting on it that the concrete guy left yesterday. Let's move that machine off the pad and let's put her body on it. Now, why did they think they needed to do that? No clue, really. They may have had some vague idea that they don't want her resting on the actual garage floor, even though it's going to get sanded down or ground down, because they don't want traces, they don't want DNA, I'm not sure. But this makes a lot of sense. They're inside the garage, there's that pad on the floor. So they pull her out, and the reason why she's stretched out flat is simply to make sure that she will fit on that pad. Don takes her shoulders and Anita Baird takes her feet. I don't know. And they just kind of arrange her on that pad, which might have been, let's say, 5 feet long. She can be placed diagonally. She's 5'6 to 5'8, and she'll fit on it. And then they throw a tarp over her. All right. So the car is in the garage. Hay's car is hidden. The body is hidden. Now they have to go get Don's car. So they leave. They both have to leave, of course. And in the meantime, and boy, does this fit with what we know about Alonzo Sellers. Sellers comes to the house to get started on the job. And he opens the garage door, expecting it to be all cleared out the way it was the day before, and for his equipment to be all ready to go. And instead, there's a car parked in the garage. A car that he's never seen before. It wasn't there yesterday when he was there. And then his machine has been pulled off the pad, which he doesn't like. And there's something on that pad covered with a tarp. What on earth is that? So, of course, he pulls it back, and it's a body. Now, as I said last time, we're going to have a whole episode about Alonzo Sellers. So I will just say here that Alonzo Sellers' supervisor at Coppin State College had a variety of interesting things to say about his employee. And one of those things was that he seemed to have kind of a thing for young Asian girls. How exactly he knows this, I don't know. I guess Alonzo confided in him. Well, guess what? Here's a young Asian girl. But she's dead, of course. She's clearly dead. So let me go back to something that Sarah Kalin, the detective, inspector, criminologist whom Rabia Chaudhry and Colin Miller have had come on their relaunch of Undisclosed in the first few episodes that were about new evidence in Adnan's case and the Heyman Lee case. She postulated that Sellers might have had some kind of necrophiliac instincts, that seeing a young girl's body would have really excited him. I'm not sure at all that the dead body part is relevant, but Alonzo Sellers likes Asian girls, and nobody's there, and he can't do the job anyway because that car is in the way, so who knows what he did during the time before Don and his mother returned with Don's car and Anita Baer driving her own car. We have been told multiple times that when Hay's body was discovered in the woods, that her clothing was disarranged, that her blouse and her bra were pulled up, exposing her breasts, and that her skirt was pulled up, pretty much exposing her underwear, but she's still wearing her underpants and her pantyhose. So I had always postulated, and it still may be perfectly true, that this disarrangement of her clothing was not caused by anything deliberate, that it was caused by her body being pulled up and over that big log, and it just kind of got caught on things and pushed around. So, as I say, that may be perfectly true. It also may be true that Alonzo Sellers decided he would do a little private inspection of this body while he was on his own. So while he's doing whatever he's doing, the garage door starts to open. Don and his mom are back. They just want to see what the lay of the land is. Anita Baird has probably remembered, oh my goodness, Alonzo Sellers was supposed to come today to work on the garage floor. I wonder what he's doing. And of course, his truck would have been parked out in front of their house. So whatever it was, Alonzo Sellers, I think, is kind of caught in the act of doing something with this body. He certainly is caught in the act of having taken the tarp off and realize that there's a dead body sitting in this garage that he was supposed to do work in. Now they're all kind of equally incriminated as far as the aftermath. Not as far as the killing is concerned, of course. That's on Don alone. But the aftermath. And you can imagine them kind of staring at each other. Alonzo has a criminal record. They don't know that. Alonzo doesn't want to go to the police. He should, of course. He should immediately call 911 and say, there's a dead body in the garage at 708 East McPhail Road. But he doesn't do that. And I say in my book, and I would restate here, that he was probably given some kind of cover story. I'm not sure how clear the marks of strangulation would be at this point. maybe a couple of hours after Hay's death, they, that is Don and Anita Baird, spin him a tale. Who knows what they said, but they pass it off as an accident. I may think that Alonzo Sellers is a pretty weird dude, and he is, and he does have some rather unsavory things on his police record, of course, or they wouldn't be in his record, but I don't think he would knowingly participate in the cover-up of a murder. That just, to me, seems a little much. So, they say this was an accident, blah, blah, blah. Don is only 20, blah, blah, blah. His whole life will be ruined. Can you help us hide the body? And besides, what were you doing with this girl's body when we drove up, huh? You know, violating a corpse? That's a crime, whether he was violating it or not. Who knows? So they're caught in this web. And I would, again, I'm postulating, but I'm trying to go according to what we actually know. They say, you need to help us get this body off this property. But we can't do it tonight. So we want you to come help us move it tomorrow. The conversation could have gone a number of different ways. We just don't know. You'll be astounded to know. I'm not going to give you a word-for-word imagined conversation. But there's some kind of deal made. And I would also suspect that it's not just, are you going to call the police or are you going to help us? I think some money changed hands. Not a huge amount of money. Baird and Don and Catherine Michelle are not wealthy, but I think they promised him some money if he would come help move the body. Why do I think that? Because of the fact that when Sellers takes his lie detector test, of which much more later, he's going to say that he was nervous and he flunked the test because he was afraid he was going to be late for an appointment with a realtor, that he and his wife were going to buy a house. And Sellers does end up owning a very nice house, only half a mile from Woodlawn. Much has been made of this fact, but I believe, with the great Bob Ruff's support in my corner, that that is not where Sellers lived at the time. So I'm imagining that he had been doing these side jobs, saving up money for a down payment, and that the money that he's promised from Anita Baird is enough to put him over the top. Come back tomorrow and we'll pay you the rest, maybe, who knows, a couple thousand dollars? I'll pay you $1,000 now. I'll write you a check. Tomorrow morning you come back and you help put the body somewhere removed from us and I'll pay you the other $1,000. It is almost certainly Sellers who suggested Lincoln Park. And that reasoning has two prongs. Number one, Lincoln Park was known as a dumping ground for dead bodies. But number two, Sellers was quite well acquainted with Lincoln Park. Even though he's going to tell the police when he's reporting finding the body that he had never been in Lincoln Park before. That is absolutely not true. Again, his supervisor is going to be a huge source of information about Mr. Sellers and his sexual adventures in Lincoln Park. We'll get to that. So the deal is struck. Sellers drives off. He goes back home. He says, okay, Lincoln Park opens at sunrise. I'll plan on getting here at 7. It's about an hour from the McPhail Road house to Lincoln Park. Sellers may have even said, I know where there's a parking lot. We can easily pull off. Nobody will be there early in the morning, and we can easily get the body into the woods. But as I keep pointing out, the big crowbar in the spokes is the ice storm. He's heard that there's going to be a storm. I'm sure everybody has heard the warnings. I don't think anybody quite realized how bad it was going to be. So they all get up the next morning. The storm has started around 4. Schools are closed and it's sleeting and everything's icing up. The roads are hazardous. Everybody's being told, stay off the roads. Trees are being brought down. Power lines are being brought down. It is very, very dangerous to be out there. I will assume that the phone lines are still up between Bel Air and where Alonzo Sellers lives. And they're able to talk to each other via landline and say, this is not workable. This is not going to happen today. Let's see how things look tomorrow. And of course, tomorrow is just as bad or worse because now the storm has been going on for a whole day. We know that a state of emergency was declared across the Baltimore area and that the storm raged for 2 days. So they probably are able to touch base Friday afternoon. If the phone lines have been brought down, crews are out putting them back up by Friday afternoon. And that's when the plan is made to take Hay's body to Leakin Park Saturday morning. I have a good reason for saying this. It's not just supposition that that would be the first day after the ice storm that they would be able to do this. I'm saying this because Don has a second faked timesheet, this time for the 16th. Why did they bother with this? And I've batted this idea around. I put this question to my husband, who is the batter arounder of ideas as well as the tech guy. And he suggested, and I think this is pretty clear, pretty tenable, that the idea would have been, well, we're going to give Sellers some money, and he's also in danger now of being an accessory after the fact, of being charged. But if he gets any funny ideas that he's going to implicate Don in this, I'm assuming that it is Don plus Sellers who go to Leakin Park to place the body there. Well, we'll just tell him that Don's going to have an alibi for Saturday morning. And so if he tries to implicate him, he's going to look pretty foolish. The timesheet for Don for the Hunt Valley store for Saturday morning is from approximately 9 till 1. So the store doesn't open till 9, so that's the earliest they can make it. And you might say, well, you're assuming that this is fake, just like you're assuming that the other one is faked. And believe me, as I mentioned, we're going to go into the timesheets in excruciating detail. But let me just say here that we know beyond a shadow of a doubt that this Saturday timesheet is faked because there is not enough time between the end of the shift that Don supposedly worked at Hunt Valley around 1 o'clock and the beginning of the shift that he actually does work at Owings Mills, starting at about 25 after 1. The time gap between the end of his shift, his supposed shift at Hunt Valley, and the beginning of his real shift at Owings Mills is only 23 minutes. And if you look this up on MapQuest, which of course was the precursor or a precursor of Google Maps, you will see that the length of time needed to make that trip was 23 minutes. I believe Bob Ruff actually drove that route. And he said, yes, you can make it in 23 minutes. But that makes no allowance for the two sets of activities that would have to be done on either end. The 23 minutes doesn't start until you've actually gotten on the road outside first of Hunt Valley, and then as you turn into the parking lot of Owings Mills. There is no allowance made for having to walk out to your car. First of all, check out at Hunt Valley, which Bob Ruff confirmed had to be done manually. You had to type in your information on a keyboard. It's not a swipe card. And then you have to walk out to your car, and then you have to navigate the parking lot and get to the exit of the actual shopping mall parking lot itself. And as I thought about this, I was thinking, you know, I bet those parking lots were jammed to the hilt by this point at around 1 o'clock. Because remember, everything's been shut down for 2 days. But now the sun has come out, the roads are cleared, and people are completely stir crazy. And one of the places they want to go is the mall. So I bet getting out of that parking lot took some time. Then he drives 23 minutes, and then he has to do the same thing in reverse, this time for real, at Owings Mills. Navigate the parking lot. He probably had to park a ways away from the store because of all the crowds. Susan Simpson, by the way, came up with this idea. I better give her credit. And then he has to walk all the way into the store, and then he has to check in. We are talking, I would say, 10 or 15 minutes added on to the 23 minutes, which is all that's allowed for the trip from checkout to check in. It cannot be done. It is physically impossible. So this is Don's alibi for hiding the body. For a long time, I thought, why did they bother with doing this second time card? I used the term in the last episode that they were over-egging the pudding. But that was before I had batted the idea around with my husband, and he had come up with this really great idea about insulating themselves from sellers getting cold feet or deciding that he was going to be an upstanding citizen and turn Don in. Well, now they've protected themselves from that. What happened instead of Don going to Hunt Valley to work Saturday morning? At first I thought, well, they would have wanted to go as soon as it was light to be sure that there would be the minimum traffic on the roads and that there would be nobody there in the park. But of course, then that means that this 9 o'clock alibi is completely useless. And I wonder if perhaps they decided, well, let's wait a little bit later and let's leave for the park at, say, 8 o'clock. By then, the sun is up. It's starting to dry off the roads. If there's any residual ice left from the night before, from the road still being wet and the temperature dipping below freezing, they cannot risk having an accident. I would also postulate that they do not take the interstate. You can take, I think it's 66 and 495, something like that, down and around and up to Leakin Park from Bel Air, where Don lives. But the chances of there being a lot of highway patrolmen out watching for accidents, as they know perfectly well, everybody's going to want to be out and about. So let's go on Highway 40. I believe it's a state road. And that's going to take us a little longer, but it'll be out of the public eye a little bit more. So they get on the road, we'll say 8 o'clock, maybe a little bit earlier. The sun's been up for a little while. Things look pretty good. And Sellers says, okay, and we'll just go to that parking lot. Nobody will be there yet. If we get there before 9, the Nature Center doesn't open till 9. And nobody's going to be hiking a trail or playing on a playground or having a picnic when everything's still cold and there's still a lot of ice around. So we should be fine. What happened? I think that they got to the turnoff for that parking lot, which has signs, of course, saying park closes at sunset. Park hours are from sunrise to sunset only. And that barrier, we've all seen it, that heavy metal crossbar slash gate that's used to block off things that are supposed to be closed that are outdoors, like a trail, or in this case, a parking lot. Oh, shoot, they think, or words to that effect. We can't get into this parking lot. And the road itself, they're on Franklintown Road, which is the narrow two-lane road that winds through the middle of Leakin Park. That's the obvious place to go. And they were going to be off that road, and now they can't get off. And there's no shoulder. If you look at pictures of this stretch of the road, the guardrails come right to the edge of the road. And so if you're going to stop, you're going to have to stop in the middle of the road, in the middle of your lane, that is. So sellers may have said, I think I remember a place not too far from here where there's a little shoulder. Or maybe he just says, let's keep going. We'll go real slowly and see if there's any place we can pull off. Either way, within it's less than a mile, they spot the place where we're pretty sure the vehicle with the body pulled off, because Hayes' body is going to be in a straight line from this point. It's a break in the guardrails, and there are two concrete barriers. They're sometimes called Jersey barriers there, and they're set, I'm going to say, maybe a couple of feet back from the edge of the road. Why they're there, why the guardrail doesn't just keep going continuously, I don't know. I'm assuming it was the same in 1999 as it is today. And so there's not enough room to pull off completely, but at least half of the width of the pickup truck. By the way, I think they're driving Catherine Michelle's truck. I don't think Sellers wants a dead body in his truck. So they pull off. They get her body out of the truck bed, of course, nervously keeping an eye out to see if anybody by any chance is driving through the park. And they get her over that barrier, and they walk back into the woods 126 feet to these two huge fallen trees or logs. They're called both things. And by the way, at least as it looks like today, you can see those huge logs from the road. So they pull off, and one of them may very well have said, look, we can get her back behind those huge trees, fallen trees, and she should be pretty well hidden. So they walk back there, the two of them, one of them her feet, one of them her shoulders and her head. They hoik her up over the first log and put her down, cover her barely with some dirt and some leaves. There's a rock put on one of her hands. Why, I'm not quite sure. Rigor would have long since passed off, but for whatever reason. And then she's kind of huddled up on her side. We know this, but that does not at all match the postmortem lividity, which of course has long since been fixed. And they look down at her and they breathe a sigh of relief, and they go back to the truck and they turn around and they go back to Don's house. And Sellers accepts the second half of his payment, and he goes back home. And you can imagine him, maybe, saying to his wife, okay, I made enough money on that job, without specifying what job it was, and we can now go ahead and make a bid on that house. We've got enough for the down payment. At some point, of course, he would have loaded his equipment back in his own truck and taken it back to the rental place, but we won't worry too much about that. Did the McPhail Road garage floor ever get ground down and resurfaced? I'm going to say probably not, but who knows? So at this point, everybody thinks, okay, this is a horrible thing that's happened, but we've managed to cover it up. Don has an alibi. The body has been removed to a place far removed from us. We'll worry about the car later, but for now, we're set. Are they set? Well, no. Tune in next week to hear about all of Don's cockamamie stories to the police and how his alibis were fabricated. See you then.